The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 209.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey guys, welcome to this evening's live stream. I hope you are well. Make sure you check out the Rebel Capitalist channel. That's my other channel on YouTube where I go over things that come across my desk or come across my computer, things I find interesting in the news 2 to 3 times per day. So you got to check that out. You'll enjoy it. Okay, guys, let's dive into your questions. Does velocity slow as more money is invested in the stock market? Since stocks are not always consumption, money just sit there. Yeah, for sure. It's a good point. If this is leading the reason for no CPI inflation yet, well, that's okay. So velocity really isn't included in the CPI calculation, although that affects CPI. And as most of you know, the Fed stopped calculating, or at least sharing with us, the M2 money supply number. What a shocker, right? Don't tell them what you don't want them to know. Maybe that's their game plan. But, and you know what I'm going to do tomorrow morning? I'm going to look at velocity because the Fed measures velocity. But how do you measure velocity if you're not measuring M2? Because I don't know if they stopped doing M1. Maybe they're using velocity with GDP, nominal GDP, divided by M1. I thought they were doing M2. But you see my point. If they stop doing M2, well, then how are they going to calculate velocity? Maybe it's because they're using M1. But I don't know. Maybe they stopped doing M1. I don't know. I've been out of the loop since like Thursday. So I'll have to re-engage tomorrow morning. But I think that's kind of an interesting question. But yeah, Aaron, I think that's a good point, buddy. If the money just goes right into the stock market, then it could be, you know, another thing that I want you to think through, Aaron, when you get a chance, I think you'll find fascinating, is the way the government calculates savings. They don't just go to everyone's bank account and say, how much are you saving? It's actually an equation that they get from the IRS. It's really bizarre. And if you dive into, it's hard to find. But if you dive into how the number is measured as far as the savings rate, you'll just think to yourself, how can this doesn't equal savings? Like this, it's nonsense. it's totally arbitrary. So my point is we see the savings rate go up, but is the savings rate going up or is the delta between incomes and spending going directly into the stock market? And not necessarily into savings accounts, which would quite frankly make a lot more sense to me. Next, do Austrian economists address something like the tragedy of commons or externalities? I'm not sure, Eagle, because I've never really studied Austrian economists or Austrian economics. I haven't studied Keynesian. I haven't taken an economics class in my life, nor have I taken a finance class. Yeah, I almost flunked out of high school, so I don't know. But what I pick up from Austrian economics or Keynesian economics is just what I pick up when I'm researching things that I'm trying to figure out. See, you got to understand, my process is most likely very inefficient, but it's just the only way that I do things. I don't know why. I wish I wasn't like this. Most people, what they do if they want to find out about Austrian economics or anything for that matter, they'll just read it in a book and it'll be like, or like the repo market. Let's use that as an example. They'll just try to go to blog posts or try to find a book on the topic and figure out, okay, how does this repo market thing work? I need to find out what someone's writing about it. So, oh, I see. So they're saying it does this, 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 and this. That's how most people would figure out how the repo market does or works. I can't do that for, I don't know why. I can't do that. So what I do is I try to figure out how the repo market works by myself without any instruction at all, without even a starting point. I just try to figure it out with on my legal pad or on a whiteboard. And I'll literally spend sometimes weeks trying to figure it out on my own. And then once I think I've figured it out and I've tried to poke holes in it, and I'll be like, okay, it has to work this way with the Fed and the primary dealer banks and the hedge funds and the financial institutions and interest on excess reserves and all of these things that go into the repo market. I'm like, I got it in my head. I'm like, okay, it's got to work this way. And then what I'll do, once I think I've figured it out how it works on my own without any help, without reading about it, without doing anything, then I'll read about it to see if how I was thinking about it is actually correct. So I'll put myself through a week or 2 weeks of torture where most sane people would just look it up in a book and figure it out in an hour or something like that. You see, so I don't know a lot of the technical stuff. I really don't. But what's bizarre is although I don't know how a lot of the jargon and whatnot, because I've never really read it in a book, I know how things work. I don't want to say better, but maybe, I mean, to some degree, I know how things work. Well, let's just say this. I don't know that if I know how things work better, but I know how things work in a more in-depth way because I figured it out on my own to begin with. And that's probably why when I go up and explain something like the repo market on a whiteboard, people say, oh, wow, yeah, you make it seem easy. You put it into words that I can understand. I totally get it now. And that's probably why, because I took that weird kind of roundabout approach. You know what it's like? You ever get a piece of furniture from IKEA? Most people just read the instructions and put it together. I can't do that. That's like that. My body, I can't comprehend that. I take the directions and throw them away. And then I just try to figure out how to build it on my own. And then once it's built, then if there's like a leg hanging off or something, I'll go pull the directions out of the trash and try to figure out what I did wrong. And I do the exact same thing with economics. I do the same thing with finance, investing, you name it. So is the dollar collapse bullish or bearish for U.S. manufacturing? Well, this is, you guys are asking some very good questions this evening. I can tell you guys are really thinking this through at a very deep level. Most people are very superficial about it. These have these bumper sticker things that they hear on CNBC. This is very good questions, very deep. Okay, so is the dollar collapse bull? So it should be bullish because it's going to increase the competitiveness of our exports because they become cheaper in currencies of the people we're exporting to. But there's a lot that has to come with that. So number one, well, let's go back to some Keynesian stuff to get technical, would be animal spirits. So let's just say that Venezuela. Why aren't they a booming export economy? Because although their currency turned to pixie dust, they don't have the animals. The government is so heavy-handed. There's so much regulation. No one's going to put capital to work there. No entrepreneur is going to start a business. No one is going to invest in setting up a billion-dollar manufacturing plant in Venezuela. Why? Because it's a basket case, and you're likely to lose your money because the government's going to come and take it from you, whatever you build. So it's not just about a cheap currency. There's a lot of things that go into it. And I would argue that the cheap currency is, although it's a factor, it isn't nearly as significant a factor as the rule of law, the overall attitude of society, and from a political standpoint of entrepreneurs. And right now, entrepreneurs have a target on their back. Look at California as an example, right? Let's say that California was its own country. And then let's say that Florida was its own country. And let's say they had their both had their own currency. And when we did this, the Californian currency was, they were using dollars, but they threw out their funny money, whatever they call it. We'll call them lib bucks. We'll call them BLM bucks. But let's say whatever they choose to call them, they are worth half of what the Florida bucks are worth. And, you know, does that mean that California is going to turn into a manufacturing powerhouse? Nope. I don't think so. So you see what I'm saying. But yeah, to your point, all things equal, yes, that would give some tailwind to the exports.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
How does the curve control affect the stock market? Do you see Fed indefinitely using QE to prevent healthy correction? Oh, yeah. I mean, Schiff nailed this way back in, 2009 or so. And Mark Faber talked about this a lot as well, that once you start QE, you're done. There's no going back. You can't, it's impossible. It's just, it's not a matter of, once you start QE, the only question is, to what degree are the central planners going to do quantitative easing in the future? It's not, you know, how do we go back to normal? How do we do? Remember the Fed came out, I don't know, it was Bernanke or, you know, it was supposed to be like watching paint dry when they were going to do quantitative tightening, taking their balance sheet from $4.5 trillion down to zero again, or $800 billion where it started prior to the GFC. How did that work out for them? If you don't know, it didn't work out. The market crashed in 2018 by, what was it, almost 20%? So, you know, they had the taper tantrum, they were calling it. So Jerome Powell had to reverse course. And what did this tell us? That they can't reduce the size of their balance sheet. And it gets progressively worse. Just like the heroin addict needs more and more and more drugs to feel the same effect, the economy, which is on addicted to monetary heroin, just like that, it's just like heroin guy that I use in my videos, passed out on the streets of San Francisco. It needs more and more QE. So once you take the balance sheet up to 7.5, now that high water mark, if you will, is it brings everything up. So before, they could get down to, let's call it $4 trillion on the balance sheet with quantitative tightening, before the market started to implode. Well, now that they take the balance sheet up to $7.5 trillion, they can't go back down to $4 again. No way. I don't know what the number is, but it's probably like maybe 7. And once they get down to 7, then the market's going to implode. And then they're going to have to keep going up. And it's going to get to $10 trillion. And then that line, the floor, if you will, goes up to $9.5 trillion. and then it's going to go to 15 trillion. It just doesn't end. It doesn't end. It's just, again, it's just a matter of to what degree. And as far as, let's see, how does the curve control affect the stock market? Well, see, this is a tough question. I would strongly suggest watching that video that I did the other day. It wasn't that popular, unfortunately, because I think it was one of the most important videos I've done in the last couple months. It was the one about Janet Yellen. But so what they have to do to buy the long end of the curve, I'm assuming you're talking about yield curve control, is they have to just print bank reserves. That's really the only thing the Fed can do is print bank reserves. So that's how they buy those treasuries, the 10-year, the 30-year, to lower the curve, to keep it down, prevent the 10-year from continuing to go up. At some point, the 10-year is going to get high enough where it's going to crush the economy. It's also going to crush the stock market, especially these growth names, that, you know, kind of the high flyers that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years. So they've got to do it. So they create more bank reserves. Well, what is more bank reserves? That's quantitative easing. And you say, okay, well, they've done a lot of quantitative easing and that hasn't seemed to be that big of a deal. We know the distortions that it causes. We know the malinvestment, the misallocation of resources, but they're kind of kicking the can down the road. Okay. What most people aren't thinking about is the short end of the curve. So the short end of the curve is like stuck at zero almost. We're really seeing it steepen. Even though the 10-year, the 30-year is going up, look what the 3-month is doing. Pretty much nada. Why? Because there's a completely different supply-demand dynamics at the short end of the curve than at the long end. At the long end, usually, it's people buying that, holding it, and they're buying it for the yield, if you want to call that, call 1.6 yield. At the short end, they're not really doing that. It's all these commercial banks, the primary dealer banks. They're buying those T-bills because they're pristine collateral. And that's what they need to go into the repo market. That's what they need to generate alpha or an additional return above and beyond what they can get with the bank reserves that they're just holding at the Fed. So they want to try to trade those bank reserves for pristine collateral. I mean, they can rehypothecate the T-bills and they can make a decent, you know, interest rate, let's just call it that, a return on their investment, as opposed to the 10 basis points that the Fed is paying them by keeping their bank reserves there, right? So there's a lot of demand at the short end of the curve, and we're seeing less demand. So what the Fed does is creates more bank reserves, does more quantitative easing. Okay, well, why is the short end of the curve at zero? Because there's an imbalance between the amount of bank reserves already in the system and the amount of pristine collateral. In other words, treasury bills. So if the Fed is buying the long end of the curve, they are creating more bank reserves. But what the short end of the curve is telling us is that we have too many bank reserves relative to the collateral. So my point is, if the Fed does yield curve control, they are going to exacerbate the problem the yield curve is showing us. But of course, very few people are kind of reading the tea leaves. They're just looking at the long end of the curve and they're ignoring what the short end is telling us. And then, oh, by the way, you've got Janet Yellen, who came out the other day and says, I've got this $1.6 trillion in the TGA burning a hole in my pocket. So Janet Yellen says, why on earth are we doing these auctions, you know, auctioning off treasuries, T-bills, when we've got all this money? Let's just spend the money in the TGA. Well, that's brilliant, because what does that do? More quantitative easing, because it injects more bank reserves into the commercial banking system, because those bank reserves right now are in the TGA. They're not circulating between Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. They're not in those accounts, right? So, but when Janet Yellen spends the money into the real economy, those bank reserves will go from the TGA into the commercial banking system, creating an even bigger problem. The short end of the yield curve could actually go negative, which would force the Fed in this bizarro world to not only buy the long end of the curve, but at the same time, increase interest rates. So they take the Fed funds rate up to, let's say, 1%, while at the same time, they're buying the long end of the curve. Why? Because Janet Yellen doesn't understand that by dropping $1 trillion into the market over the span of 2 months, while the Fed is buying the long end of the curve, is going to create so many bank reserves, it's going to take everything negative. Not everything, the short end. So great question, guys. And hopefully, I know it's tough without a whiteboard, but if you guys didn't follow what I was saying right there, if you have some time, I would strongly suggest watching that whiteboard video I did on the George Gammon channel. And I walk you right through it. I think I did a pretty good job of making it clear so you could understand what I mean, this could be a huge tail risk event that no one is really thinking about, other than a handful of guys like Kevin Muir. He's the guy that I first heard talk about it on Macro Voices. And so I want to give him all the credit. But there's a few analysts out there, you know, the big banks that have mentioned it. And then Kevin's done a deep dive into it. But this could just be a knockout punch out of right field that nobody is really even, it's not even on their radar at all. So we definitely need to pay attention to this over the next couple months. Assuming government is hoping people spend their stimmies, seeing a lot of people using them to speculate in stocks, simply holding onto cash idea right now, stay liquid. If you're asking what I would do with a stimmy check, I mean, I'd use it to start an online business. I'd use it to start a YouTube channel, but even without my experience, I'd do that. But I wouldn't spend it. I would just hold it. If you can find something that's cheap, I'd buy it. I mean, it just goes back to that. If you find something that's cheap, buy it. If it's not, then don't. If you own something that's expensive, sell it. I mean, if you put a gun to my head and say, George, you have to buy one stock, you know, with your stimmy check, it'd probably be gold miners. I'm not suggesting you do that, but if I was forced to do something right now with a stimmy check, that's probably what I'd do. And by the way, this is an interesting topic. When I was up in Park City, you could really see this dynamic playing out. The dynamic I'm referring to is the supply destruction we've seen by all of these small and mid-sized businesses going bust because of the lockdown, because everything that the government did in 2020 and what they're still doing today in a lot of areas. And those jobs aren't coming back. Those goods aren't coming back. Those services aren't coming back. And as an example, you can't even go to a restaurant anymore. I mean, try to go to a restaurant in Park City. Good luck with that. You're going to need a reservation like 8 years in advance. And then if you don't, if you just go into like a normal restaurant, like a, breakfast place, good luck. You're going to be waiting 2 hours. It's just everywhere you go, no matter what you're buying, you've got to wait in line for an hour. It's why? Because there's half the supply of restaurants than there was a year and a half ago. And not only is there half the supply of restaurants, but people have a lot more money because of all the stimmy checks and all the additional. And you may be a person that got left out in the cold, but on net balance, incomes just in January went up by 10%. In the United States, 10%. I mean, that's absolutely unheard of. Even in a booming economy, like a properly booming economy. So that's what you get. I mean, I went to the liquor store on Saturday night, last night, right, to get some wine for this house party that we were going to. The line at the liquor store was over 50 people deep. 50. And I said, oh, you know, the driver. I said, well, let's go to another. Oh, we can't. They're closed. So what's going to happen to prices? I mean, you can't even get an Uber. I could go down a laundry list of things that I've observed over the past couple weeks that shows you how distorted the economy actually is from a standpoint of supply and demand. We have increased demand and we have crushed supply. And what's really weird too is it turns like, it's just a bizarre world that like you got to just wait in, you know, hours just to do the simplest thing. And, you know, the solution are the animal spirits. See, that's the problem. Let's go back to technical Keynesian economics, right? So the whole thing is the government sends out these stimmy checks. Why? To increase aggregate demand. Well, what happens then? The aggregate demand brings more money into the businesses that do what? They use that money as a signal because there's so much demand for their product that they're going to expand their business. They're going to hire more workers. They're going to create more goods and services. Or it's going to bring new entrepreneurs into the mix to continue to grow the economy. That's what it's supposed to do in the Keynesian textbook. But what we can see in reality is, yes, good job. You've increased aggregate demand. Bravo. You just send people stimmy checks. You've got that part of the equation. But unfortunately, the rest of the equation, which, by the way, is far more important, you're seeing the opposite. We're not using those, you know, the government transfer payments to increase economic output through those animal spirits that Keynes talked about. No. We're either hoarding the money, putting it into the stock market, we're gambling, turning the entire U.S. economy into a casino, basically. And then the amount of goods and services is actually shrinking. And I don't like to predict things. Who knows where we are in 3 to 5 years, but I can't even imagine a United States where the price of the stuff you buy daily isn't double what it is today. That's not to say that the stock market can't crash. Housing can crash. Assets can crash. But as far as just food and building material, and I can't understand how it's not going, maybe not double, but I can't understand how it's not going to be substantially higher in the future, because the QE, once you go down that path, you just have to add more and more and more and more. And it's going to be the same thing with the government fiscal spending. In other words, stimulus. Once they go down that path, once they build the economy around people getting free money, and obviously I'm using that term loosely, you can't go back. There's no going back. You can't just say, okay, guys, you know, your incomes have increased 30% over the last, since 2019 on aggregate total, because we've been giving you all of this money, but unfortunately, we're going to have to turn off the taps. You know, that $4,000 a month you were getting, or, you know, or $2,000 a month, $3,000 a month. Sorry, you know, we're just going to, we've found the true path of enlightenment. We understand now that if we keep doing this, that it's going to lead to bad things. And so we better not do it. Like, the politicians are really going to say that. No. And the people are going to come out and they're going to demand more free money. And they'll basically say, as a group, listen, you give us more free money or we're not going to vote for you. And then it's just going to turn into a race between who can give away the most free money. And then that's a race to that's a race to stagflation. I hope I'm wrong. We'll see.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
After doing further research, 1918, I can't even say this on YouTube, but we'll call it the 1918 Surveys of Sickness, 1920, Roaring Twenties Depression, 40s War. You think we're going through that same time? I don't know. I thought about the whole 1920s and that how interesting it was that we had a great decade after the 1918 Surveys of Sickness. But boy, oh boy, were things different. My, oh my. And also, too, remember, we had the depression of the night of 1920, 21. So we had what we, you know, 1918, we all know what happened then. And then we came out of that after three waves, which is exactly what we're seeing right now, by the way. And then we had a Great Depression. If you look at the headline numbers for the 1920-21 compared to 1930, some of them are actually worse in 1920-21 than they were in 1930. As far as the unemployment rate, I mean, we went through a wicked depression to kick off the 1920s. Most people don't know that. And they don't know that why, because the government did nothing. And magically, it was a real V-shaped recovery. Then in the 1930s, the government decided to get involved, and instead of it being a 1 year or one, you know, 2 year at the most V-shaped recovery, it was 10 years of misery. So you got to ask yourself the question, what is the government doing now compared to what they were doing back then? Because back then in 1918, they didn't do a thing. Zero, nada. You think they sent out stimmy checks? I don't think so. So, and then you look at what they did or didn't do in 1920 compared to what they did do in 1930. And if we can extrapolate from that, the more government intervention you have, the longer the problem is going to be and the worse the problem is going to be. Then you have to look at how much government intervention we have now, even compared to the 1930s. So I would say that this is a great thought process, Vinny. But I mean, based on what we're seeing from government, I would say the probabilities are higher that we go from a 1918 directly to a 1930s. And unfortunately, we skip over the 1920s. What do you think about the ramifications will be from rent moratoriums? See, that's another thing. I mean, going back to what I was talking about with Park City and the overall economy in the United States with aggregate demand and supply being reduced while aggregate demand is going up, I just talked about the government transfer, the free money side of the equation. But what I didn't talk about, and you made a great point here, Rob, is what about the fact that their income has increased, but the majority of Americans' expenses have decreased? Like, oh yeah, that $2,000 mortgage payment you typically have that comes out of your income. Yeah, just, you know what? Forget about that for a couple of years. Don't worry about it. You know those rent payments you were making? Yeah, just kind of, let's just pretend those don't exist for a year or so. And, you know, here's more money from the government. And let's just, as long as we increase aggregate demand, we're all good. So it's not just the incomes have gone up. It's that the expenses, the incomes have gone up by 50%. Expenses have gone down by 50%. Oh, jeez. Wow. I mean, this just does not end well. But as far as how they're going to solve it, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that they can solve it, Rob. It's just, I mean, at least this is a program that they might stop. I mean, with the government's fiscal spending, deficit spending, and the QE, I don't think that stops. With this, maybe it at least stops at some point, just because I think even the average American, if you ask them, hey, is if we continue doing quantitative easing, is that bad? They'll just look at you like you're crazy. Like, I don't know. What the hell is quantitative easing? But if you ask the average American, hey, if we keep allowing people just to not pay rent forever, or if we keep just, if we have this mortgage forbearance forever, so people never have to pay their mortgage payment ever again, do you think that's bad or good? Intuitively, I think the average person would say, you know, that sounds great, but that's got to lead to a problem somewhere down the road. And so that's why I think that's it's probably a little less likely for this. But I think what they could do is they'll definitely, well, not definitely, but they might start sending rent checks to people to cover their rent, especially certain demographics that are favored by politicians in the current administration. So, you know, if there's a group that has been labeled as being disadvantaged, well, I mean, why wouldn't the government send them rent? I mean, they're disadvantaged, right? We need to compensate them for the struggles they have had growing up in the United States. I don't know if that happens, but it sure wouldn't surprise me. And it might benefit a few, but obviously there's a big cost benefit analysis there. And I, on that note, I would strongly encourage people to read Thomas Sowell's work and research that he did on the effects, the long-term generational effects that welfare has on individuals, families, and groups. I'll just tell you, I'll tease it by saying, not just in the United States, but Thomas Sowell went and looked at every country in the world and went back over hundreds of years, and he couldn't find one example, not even one, where a group of people was lifted out of, let's say, poverty as a result of getting welfare. He only found the opposite. He only found empirical data that would suggest that the welfare kept them poor, or in some cases made them even more poor over the long run when it goes from generation to generation to generation to generation. And let's think this through. That's what we're doing, not just with some groups in the United States, with everyone. Everyone right now is getting welfare if they make under $75,000 a year. Now, maybe some people said, F you, drunken, insolvent Uncle Sam, I don't want your money. Maybe that's you, maybe it's not. I'm not saying that there's anything ethically wrong about taking the money. I mean, listen, you're a taxpayer. If they're giving it to you, that's something that the decision that you need to make. I'm not here to pass moral judgment on that. But what I am saying is that if we look at Thomas Sowell's work in the past, he has shown that if you give, if you create this welfare culture, let's say, within a group or a state or a country, that it doesn't make the country richer. It's going to make most of the time, it's going to make the country, the group, the community, the state, the city, whatever, it's going to make them poorer over the long run. It seems the government is purposeful causing economy and velocity to go down. This would cause insolvency issues for middle class. Localizing, concentrate to the top. Your thoughts? I don't know how that would concentrate it at the top. I mean, you're not really making the rich richer by making the middle class poorer. Yeah, I don't know that I would attach a high probability to that. I attach a higher probability to like UBI and kind of the, if you want to go call it MMT, whatever you want to call it. I attach a higher probability to people continuing to get checks from the government that never would have dreamed of getting checks from the government in 2019. I don't think they're, and the government, listen, the individuals in the government have one thing they care about, and that's getting reelected. That's it. So if they have to destroy the economy to get reelected, no problem. You think that one of these politicians is going to be like, well, I could do this over here, and I know it's the right thing to do for the economy, but there's no way I'm going to get reelected. Or I could do this over here, which will definitely get me reelected, but will destroy the economy. Like, just seriously, ask yourself that question. I don't care if the politicians on the right, the left, the middle, I don't care. 99% of the politicians out there are going to, they're not even going to bat an eye. I mean, they don't even have to think about it. Oh, done. Crush the economy. Give me my power. So my point is, I don't know that they're going to purposely crush the economy. They inadvertently do it constantly. But I think their purpose intent is going to be buy votes. How do you buy votes? Well, we see how you do that. You literally send people checks in the mail. I mean, you got a question on India. The one thing you got to look though, it might be back to normal, but how many businesses are not back? And I would argue that it probably wasn't as big of a deal in India as it would be in the United States because there was so much less leverage, right? If you borrow all this money to start your business, and you've got these big payments that you've got to make, and you have to have cash flow coming in every single month or you're done. And I've never been to India. I'd love to go. I'll go there at some point in the next couple of years. But in Medellin, as an example, there were a lot of businesses that went under, but I would argue probably a lot fewer than in the United States. And by the way, they didn't do the stimmy checks. Think about how many businesses would have gone under in the United States with no government free money. I mean, what do you think? I mean, 30-40% of the businesses, restaurants, bars, small businesses, and they wouldn't be here today. So my point is if in Medellin, 10% of the businesses went under, maybe more, 20%. The reason there were fewer apples to apples, you know, comparing apples to apples, assuming we didn't have stimulus checks, is because they weren't levered up, because it was just a business that it's like a house. They don't have a mortgage on it. This, the family owns it. They've owned it for 20 years. It's a little corner store. And if they have to shut it down for 2 or 3 months, it's bad, but they're not going to go out of business because they don't have $1 million of debt that they use to start the business in the first place. And I would, this is just obviously a super broad assumption, but I would assume that India is in that same category. People aren't even wearing masks. Okay, so will the crisis affect India? I don't know what crisis you're referring to, really. But I mean, number one, I'd think about the businesses that aren't there, even if it looks like things are going back to normal. Look at how many businesses just aren't there. That's the first thing. And then with a second component of it, I just try to think through how much debt they have, and maybe that's why they're kind of tackling the problem of these lockdowns a little bit better. Maybe that's why they're handling it a little bit better than a business would here in the United States, minus the fiscal spending that we're seeing. I'd like you to talk about deflation, how right Snyder and Steve are. At what point are you convinced massive deflation is coming? I don't know. I mean, I would answer this question with another question. At what point are you convinced massive deflation is not coming? I mean, look at oil, look at copper, look at commodities, look at the 10-year, look at the dollar. I mean, at what point are you going to be like, okay, we're probably not going to get deflation? I mean, because everything right now is pointing towards inflation. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but I think you've got to kind of ask yourself this same question. And I think that let's not confuse deflation with disinflation, first and foremost, because I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I don't know if Jeff and Steve would argue that the prices of consumer goods, the stuff you buy daily, I don't know they'd argue those prices are going to go down over the next 5 years. I think they're referring to asset deflation, which is where you're getting all this excess leverage out of the system. And that's a much different question. So again, I mean, I'm not saying that the CPI is running hot right now. I am saying that you got to look at commodity prices and what they've done over the last 3 months. You got to look at what the 10-year is doing. I get it. It's still 1.6. It's nothing. And it's just a blip on the overall screen. And it could come back down for sure, especially if the Fed has to raise interest rates, because Janet Yellen inadvertently turns the short end of the curve negative. Whoops. Oh, sorry, guys. Didn't know that was going to happen. Don't mind me. I just blew up the entire global economy. So that could bring on some asset deflation pronto if the Fed has to bring up the Fed funds rate. And, you know, that could bring down the long end of the curve, too. And that could make the dollar stronger. That could really, I don't know what that would do to gold. That's interesting. But you get my point. It's I think that since right now everything is pointing towards inflation, not that that's going to happen, but just there's a lot of signs there. I would say you've got to kind of ask yourself the same question, man, and to say at what point will you be convinced that massive deflation is not coming, at least in consumer prices. Do we have three economies? The open accountable economy, the gray market, the black market. Yeah, I mean, I would say that every country has these three economies. It's just to what degree. Yeah, I think that's an easy question to answer. I think in the United States, it's more number one, where in a country like Colombia, it would be more Probably more number three. I shouldn't say that because it's not really like that anymore. But back in the 90s or back in the late 80s, it was definitely more number three. That's for sure. All right, guys. Make sure you check out the Rebel Capitalist channel. We'll end it there. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.